Consider your children. I've already talked about the fact that you have to decide between want and need, and that if you gave kids everything they wanted, you turned them into ugly, self-centered brats. But what about those real needs? Suppose you have a kid who needs a bicycle, but you don't have the money for the latest high-tech model. Your job as a verbal judo practitioner is to convince him that a good used bike, for which he will pay half, will meet his needs and give him a great sense of accomplishment and satisfaction. Holstering your divorce weapon. Aren't divorce courts filled with people who've misunderstood this same point? You get angry at your spouse and draw down on him or her with the equivalent of a policeman's deadly force, perhaps with a sentence like, "Well, if you don't like it, let's get a divorce." And your spouse, equal to the challenge, responds, "Fine, see you in court." Soon there the two of you are, filing for something neither one of you really wanted. It makes no sense, but it's what happens when we fire from the hip, when we allow the words that come naturally to our lips make a speech we live to regret. Unless we're mighty in character and depth and know how to apologize, we wind up obligated to defend our ultimatums. Our pride, our face is at stake, and we will not back down. We end up making life-changing decisions to our own detriment. The only solution is to learn to ignore the inner voice and to use every verbal judo technique we know to keep us from doing irreparable damage to ourselves and our loved ones. Give others a break, too. Don't react to their words. A spouse complaining about a wet towel on a bed, or griping about your coming home late, or a boss snapping at you about some minor matter are only symptoms of larger problems. Let the words go by. Deflect them, as I taught you earlier, and set about addressing real issues. Chapter 24. The Misunderstood Motivator. No, I'm not referring to myself, though there are days when I feel misunderstood. The misunderstood motivator is praise. When I'm praised correctly, and there are a myriad incorrect ways to offer praise, I feel most understood and appreciated. Have you ever felt suspicious when praised? You're not alone. I believe suspicion of praise is universal, because it so frequently precedes criticism, which I will discuss. For example, "I really enjoyed your solo. It was beautiful. Now can I give you a few hints on your wardrobe and stage presence? See how this compliment was yanked away like a rug from under the singer?" This happens so often that when we hear a compliment, we can't help but wait for the other shoe to drop. Regardless, I contend that praise remains the most effective motivator and disciplinarian there is. Effective and genuine praise does far more than make people feel good. They tend to do voluntarily what they are praised for. But if they are criticized, they will do just what they need to get by. Offering praise communicates and reinforces your values. And when praise is specific, as I will discuss more fully, it appears more authentic and increases your credibility, regardless of your role. Praise is part of your arsenal. We know very little about praise, but it can be a dynamic tool. In my opinion, it is the most powerful teaching weapon we have. Praise has to be believable to work effectively, and people seem to feel as uneasy about praise as they do about criticism. They distrust it instinctively, for they think criticism will follow, so praise has to be given with care. My first praise principle is that if you plan to praise people, never follow it with criticism. If you do, from then on, whenever people hear a compliment from you, no matter how sincere, they will also hear in their minds, "But." I'm not saying you cannot or should not criticize people when necessary. If you must, criticize first, then leave them with praise. You might tell an employee, "You know, I'm really upset about the way you handled that shipping problem yesterday afternoon. It did no good to blame the distribution system, as overworked and under-resourced as they are right now. You or someone you delegated should have simply apologized unconditionally to the customer and made sure the shipment went out immediately. That's the way you've been trained, and you have demonstrated that attitude many times. That's why you're in the position you're in. Though I want you to remember to respond the way you know is best in the future, I also want to tell you that your overall work has been exemplary. Specifically, your monthly reports are always right on the mark, giving me the information I need in a format that makes me look good when I pass them along. I know you can do that well in all areas, and I'm counting on you to do that. I often ask my seminar students, what is it that makes good praise? Almost invariably, they'll answer, sincerity. That's close, but I say, all right, how do we make praise sound sincere? One of the ways has to do with where you insert praise into the conversation. Last, not first. Not first and last, with a criticism sandwiched in between either. That's a popular management recommendation, but I think people see through that as easily as they see through the compliment then criticism technique. The employee misses the first bit of praise because he's been called on the carpet and is waiting for the other shoe to drop. Then he gets the bad news and he can't appreciate the other half of the sandwich cookie. Whatever came before the but, he no longer believes because it was an obvious setup. Whether it really was or not is irrelevant. If that's the way he feels, that's reality to him. The second way to effect the sincerity of praise is to make it as specific as possible. There is something disconcerting about, nice going, good job, appreciated that. It's much better when someone says, to use the singing example again, I enjoyed your solo, especially the song you selected and the way you interpreted that chorus. I felt as if I were young and in love again. I was the happy beneficiary of specific praise, and I'm pleased to say it helps bolster my point. To use one of my earlier phrases, I was an unconscious competent at public speaking. I have saved until now the news that I was a stutterer as a child, because I believe it has more impact when you have established in your mind that I make my living by giving speeches hundreds of times a year. When I was a student, I couldn't get out sentences that began with words like why, what, or how. Basically, I couldn't ask any questions. This dogged me into my freshman year of college. I had to rephrase questions so they wouldn't start with a W or an H word. I had to say things like, tell me about that. It seems that wouldn't work if this was the case. I didn't know it, but I was becoming more verbally fluent because of my weakness. If I put what in the middle of a sentence, I could get it out. So I began most of my questions with a dependent clause, which is not a bad way to pose a question. Still, I was insecure, and for years I didn't even consider teaching, let alone public speaking, as a career. Yet as I gained confidence, I saw the stutter begin to disappear, until finally I was a teacher, then a professor, and finally a public speaker. No one knew that I still harbored insecurities about my speaking ability because of those painful memories, so I took any praise for my oratory with a grain of salt. At times I was tempted to say, I'm glad you enjoyed it, but if you only knew. In the mid-1980s, I spoke to an audience of realtors in Chicago and learned a valuable lesson. Afterward, people filed out gushing general praise like, great speech, loved it, best I've ever heard. As was my habit, I pasted on a smile and responded with, thank you, oh yes, thanks, oh yes, appreciate that. The last guy to leave the room said, I really enjoyed that. And I started in with one of the variations of my, oh yes, when he got my attention. When he added, specifically, I cocked my ear. He said, specifically, I like the way you use little everyday stories to teach complex points like empathy and setting of context. Most speakers don't do that. Those stories made me see your points. Thanks for putting those in there. And he walked out. The benefits of specific praise. 1. Specific praise feels good. It made me feel good. The specificity of his praise reached me as no general praise could have. Specific praise is powerful praise. General praise is just good manners. 2. Specific praise is believable. Because he had been specific, I believed him. He was credible, and that made him look good too. 3. Specific praise always either reinforces or teaches. It made me learn something about myself as a speaker. In all honesty, I had not previously had a clue to my success. I knew I was in demand and that people seemed to appreciate and enjoy my speaking. But if I had had to guess, I would have said it was because they liked my style. I'm expressive, hard-driving, and I don't do a lot of gyrating. I get to the point. It's just in-your-face principles and give them the bottom line. I have always been a storyteller, But until that guy pointed out that the specific detail of my illustrations made my points come alive for him, I didn't know. I might have drifted from that technique, but once I knew it was effective, I went back and emphasized stories and illustrations for all my presentations. His specific praise taught me to be a better speaker. 4. Specific praise gets passed along. 2 years later, I ran into a guy in Jacksonville, Florida, who said, "Are you that crazy guy from Albuquerque who teaches verbal judo? I've got a friend in Chicago who raved about your course. He couldn't remember your name, but he never forgot what you did." I said, "What was that?" He said, "You taught with specific little stories the way Einstein taught physics. My friend had to give a presentation before his bosses, and he completely redid it based on that one principle alone. And he gave the best speech." It pays to listen and watch and take that extra time to look at what somebody does that makes you feel good. Then instead of just blurting, "Great job," be specific. An example. Let's say I have an employee, I'll call him John, who writes poorly. His reports are a mishmash of abstract generalities. I send him to a writing course, but he's not much better. I look through 30 of his reports, and they're all bad. My natural inclination might be to take a handful of those reports and shake them in his face and say, "Didn't you learn anything? These are outrageous. If you don't get better, we'll fire you." Obviously, that would be ineffective. On the basis of my principles of praise, here's what I should do. I should take the time to dig through all those reports to find at least one paragraph that works. It might just be dumb luck on John's part, but something somewhere in that mass of writing has to be something worthwhile. Then instead of trying to resort to criticism and an ultimatum as a motivator, I should try specific praise. I should not call John in, but rather seek him out. I should say, "John, I was looking over some of your reports, and I was impressed with this paragraph and how specific it was. That's good, because when you're this specific, it helps me understand what you do so I can supervise you better. That's good for you, that's good for me, that's good for everybody. Thanks for taking the time to do that." You think his next report won't be 15 times more specific? You can bet he'd go home and tell his wife that night that the boss had praised him, and there's little question that he'd remember why. People do what they're praised for. If I were only to criticize him, he would just shore up his reports just enough to keep me off his back. Criticized people generally do only enough to reach a level of what management experts call minimal competency. That's what's wrong with labor in our society. Now let's say John is doing better on his reports, but he's still neglecting to open and close them with power and influential statements. Now I can go to him and say, "John, your reports are more specific than ever, and I appreciate it," and this one open with a powerful, grabbing sentence. "Open and close the rest of them that way, and you're writing the best reports we can get. I know you can do it." A quiz. Beside exercising the principle of specific praise, what other verbal judo principle am I using? If you said I was raising John's expectations as a way to motivate him, you're among the best readers I've got. If you keep catching on to these principles and remembering them, well, you get the point. Motivate by raising expectations. Raise expectations not through criticism, but through praise. Praise specifically, and you will find yourself resorting to criticism rarely. Criticism without ostracism. You can, and many times should, deliver criticism effectively, directly, and even bluntly. As the flip side of the praise principle, the trick here is to follow the criticism, not precede it, with praise. That way, despite his mistakes, the person being corrected and criticized will still feel a part of the team, a valued player. If praise is doled out before criticism, as is usually the case, the person will feel manipulated. Often it's appropriate to remind the person, "If I didn't value you and care about you, or if I wasn't concerned with how you fit into the organization, I wouldn't bother to deal with you about this problem. If you were on your way out of the company, or I thought you were unsalvageable, I wouldn't waste my time, would I?" Do football coaches holler at marginal players? No. They push and prod the ones they count on and need the most. when you are criticized. I have just a few simple guidelines for taking criticism, which we all must at times. None of these will be new to you, but it is worthwhile to list them here as reminders. 1. Maintain eye contact. Don't roll your eyes as if you are amazed at the stupidity of the person doing the criticizing. And don't cast your eyes down either. That is a sign of resignation or defeat. The person criticizing you probably doesn't want you to wallow in self-pity. Take it like an adult. Look the person in the eye and indicate that you're listening. 2. If you disagree, hold your tongue for the time being. If you constantly interrupt to correct an inaccuracy or plead your case, you're going to look worse. Maybe you're right and the criticizer is wrong. Still, arguing and appearing defensive will only make the person believe more strongly that he is right. The time may come when it is appropriate to defend yourself, but gather your thoughts first and be prepared to discuss them calmly, just to try to balance the record. 3. Nod and show an open body language that says you're not only listening, but also that you're hearing and understanding. You're not necessarily agreeing, but you're getting the message. 4. Use phrases that confirm your openness to be corrected, such as, "Uh-huh, yes, okay, I hear you. I understand what you're saying. I'm willing. I'll make every effort. I'll work on that. Thanks for pointing that out." 5. When you have the floor, use the opportunity not only to defend yourself, but also to reiterate that you welcome such input and want to learn. Insist on a follow-up meeting with a request such as, "Could I check back with you to make sure I'm making progress and doing what you want?" Being criticized and responding appropriately can be better than never having been noticed at all. Your demeanor and ability to choose your words carefully make all the difference. Chapter 25. You can punish without drawing blood. As parents, we sometimes have to punish our children. As employers, we sometimes have to punish employees. You may dislike doing this or even the idea of it, but you can't deny the reality. The ability to punish effectively is a necessary skill. It's been my experience and observation that in our society, we do not wield the sword of authority with great skill. This has led me to develop what I call the principle of punishment. It goes like this. Though there are many ways to punish, when doing so, you must use language without bias. In other words, never mix emotion and punishment. I realize this is a whole lot easier said than done, especially with children. Parents are in all probability lying if they say they have never punished in anger. That's why cops deal with so much child abuse and domestic violence. We all know better, but knowing and doing are too often two different things. A few hints may help you maintain the gap between emotion, or feeling, and handing down punishment. Keep in mind, if you're so angry at someone that you simply must express it, do so. But be careful not to affect punishment at the same time. Let's say you overhear your son speaking disrespectfully and totally inappropriately to your wife. It makes you mad, and you know he would benefit from knowing that. It's not all bad to light into him, but force yourself not to get into pronouncing a sentence until you're calmer. In other words, you might raise your voice so he knows you're serious. You might say, "Listen, son, I'm not going to stand for your talking to your mother that way. It's disrespectful, and it's going to stop, or you and I are going to have trouble. Remember, that's not just your mother you're talking to. She's also my wife." That will often get a raised eyebrow, but better yet, you have not followed your instinct to threaten what that trouble might be. You haven't flown off the handle and said you were going to knock his block off or ground him for a month or take away his driving privileges. That is something you want to avoid, because in the heat of the moment, you may make one of those famous speeches you'll live to regret. You'll hand down a sentence that will be hard to enforce and probably be as much of an inconvenience for you and your wife as for your son. If you have to chew out an employee, do it. But don't, in the excitement of the moment, say, "You're finished in this company. I'd fire you if I could. You're on probation for 6 months. No raise for you, etc., etc., etc." You might say to the employee, as you might say to your son, "I want to discuss this with you tomorrow to determine what we're going to do about it." In the meantime, you will have a better handle on what really went wrong, on how purposeful the infraction might have been, how serious the consequences, and what the most remedial and effective punishment would be. Anything decided in the heat of the moment will likely be counterproductive, cost the guilty party his face and dignity, and wind up being a burden for you. The moment you use words that indicate you have lost respect for someone or don't like him, he shuts down and quits listening. Your personal self has intruded and spoiled your professionalism. Homeschool. I learned a lesson with my son Taylor when he was 6 years old. I told him one day, "Don't throw the football in the living room because that vase over there came from Beijing, China, and was given to me by an old kung fu master. If you break that vase, you're history because that thing's irreplaceable. And by the way, my friend, you are not." Now, obviously, I was teasing him and he knew it. But he also knew I was quite serious about the value of the vase and the import of my prohibition. 2 weeks later, at 3 in the afternoon, I heard a tremendous crash in the living room and knew immediately what had happened. I hurried in to find Taylor and the football and the vase in pieces. I was so angry that I worried what I might do or say to him, and somehow I was able to control myself. I simply said, "You and I had a contract. No football in the living room. Go to your room, and I'll see you in the morning." Then I went out to the driveway where I had a hanging bag and beat that bag until my hands bled. I took my feelings out on the bag, not on the boy. Suppose I had not done that. Suppose I had done what I had too often with my daughter. What if I had let my anger overwhelm me and said the first thing that came to mind? I would have begun lying. I would have said, "USOB? That's lie number one. You never listen. Lie number two. You never do what I say. Lie number three. Then when I sent him to his room, I would be pronouncing the same punishment, but I would have a different kid behind the door. I would have had a little boy steeped in righteous resentment for 16 hours. He would have been crying, rocking back and forth, thinking, "I am not an SOB. I do too listen. I do too do what he says. He's so unfair, blah, blah, blah." 16 hours later, he would come out worse than he was when he went in. It's easy to snap and use verbal karate, to lash out and hurt someone with a wound that will never go away. Think of the long-term effect. How many times can we snap at our children that way and not turn them into mean, nasty street lizards who hate authority, hate cops, hate anyone in control? What will prevent them from turning to gangs for solace? The goal. I've established that the worst abuse in this world is verbal. So if you want to be an effective punisher, you must learn to use language disinterestedly, unemotionally, and without bias. The goal of punishment should be positive. It is not to inflict pain or exact revenge. Rather, it is to reconstruct, to make better, to educate. If we agree that remediation and rehabilitation is the goal of effective punishment, why is the language associated with it usually so negative? Why do we feel the need to put people down when we punish them? Don't think that I am unaware how difficult this lesson is. Only a fool would tell you that it's easy to control yourself when you're angry, but it can be done. And it's crucial to your effectiveness in punishing and to the well-being of both the person you're punishing and you. Stopping and silently counting to 10 or 20 sounds like an old cliché, but it's not a bad idea if it works. Train yourself to do the opposite of what you feel. If you feel like shouting, whisper. If you feel like striking, caress. If you feel like storming from the room, stay put. Take control. Feel the power it gives you. Above all, separate emotion from punishment. Chapter 26. Dancing When You Might Have Stumbled. Here I want to celebrate the mastery of verbal judo. Many who have incorporated the various principles in their lives have elegantly succeeded in situations where once they might have suffered loss or embarrassment. You can succeed too if you're committed to following through on what you have learned. I was one who suffered as much as anyone for lack of having discovered and mastered these principles. The failure of my marriages was largely due to the fact that no one had ever told me to not express my feelings when I got angry. Rather than saying, I love you. What's wrong? I said things like, if you don't like it, too bad. You want a divorce? Okay. We all find it hard, especially men, to say what we really feel and mean, and so we resort to shortcuts. We translate disappointment into anger. We translate frustration into anger. Because it's easier for us to look good, macho, and powerful if we lash back. Just as in the workplace, when you come home, you must play a series of roles. You're a parent, a disciplinarian, a lover, a helper, a friend, a psychologist, or whatever is necessary at a given moment. I would take abuse and deflect it on the street, but then at home I wanted to relax. I dropped all pretense of skill at this, and my wife would say, "How come you don't treat me as well as you treat those street lizards you deal with? You're snapping at me like a dog." She was right. Eventually, it cost me the marriage. In a later relationship, after I had begun developing this program, but before I had mastered the ninja skill of making skillful communication invisible, my wife would say, "Don't use that verbal judo crap on me." You're going to make mistakes. You're going to stumble. But it's better to stumble using the right technique with good motives. As important as learning these principles is making verbal judo part of the fabric of your life and character and personality. Every time you interact with somebody in your family, on the street, or in your workplace, make it your goal to improve the situation or the relationship. If you try to control people, you'll be breathing down their necks. You can't force people to do what you want in today's society. You have to use your words strategically. Generate voluntary compliance and cooperation by directing rather than controlling. Go ahead, make my day. If you know movies, you know that famous Clint Eastwood line from the Dirty Harry series. He says to a punk, in effect, "Give me a reason to blow your head off." I gotta tell you, I love Clint Eastwood and all his westerns and cop movies. But I bring that up in classes with real cops, and I have to say, there, for example, is the difference between TV and life. In the real world, you point a gun at a guy and say that, he reaches for the gun, and you shoot him. You're in deep trouble. In court, it would be shown that you invited him to reach for a weapon so you could exterminate him, and you would be tried as a murderer. Clint's approach may make for good theater, and we may all cheer when Dirty Harry exacts justice from the sleazeball, but that's the opposite of verbal judo. When what we say or do forces someone to respond under duress, to whom are we giving the power to control the situation? To whom are we handing over the decision-making power? The badge wearer is the one who is supposed to make the citizen's day. The proper approach is, I'll make your day for you. You want to resist arrest? You will not succeed. You want to fight a cop? You'll be subdued before you begin. You want to rape this woman or sell crack cocaine on these corners? I'm not going to let that happen. Rodney King. Irrespective of your opinion of the verdict that resulted in the Los Angeles riots, a major question was brought to light by the Rodney King arrest. I happen to be one who believes the situation got out of hand and that entirely too much force was used. I believe in the justice system and the integrity of juries, and I have my questions about why King didn't simply obey and go immediately to a non-threatening prone position. I know he was a repeat offender and was a large and dangerous man, but I have eyes as you do. I saw the videotape and was repulsed. More important, though, for the first time in America, a question was raised. What if the police, the thin blue line between peace and disharmony in our society, are the problem? That was something we didn't want to think about, and for the most part, had never considered. Charges of police brutality were far and few between, and were often brought by obviously guilty parties. But when people who have long doubted those in power now start to wonder about the police themselves, we face a chilling question. Why should anybody trust the police to begin with? I say to cops in my classes, if out of the 300 in this room, there's just one of you suckers who thinks that showing up and kicking ass and taking names and humiliating people is what your job is about, what happens to the thin blue line between order and disorder, between peace and violence? It's gone. That's the tragedy of the Rodney King affair. A lot of people say that it was business as usual in L.A., And of course, a lot of LA cops say, no, it isn't. To me, the saddest part was that when it happened, I was in the midst of a contract with the Los Angeles Police Department to teach verbal judo to most of its officers. Several of the cops involved in that ugly altercation were scheduled to sit in on one of my seminars the very next week. I like to think that something they might have gleaned from that would have put a different spin on what happened that night. I can only hope that they would have danced rather than stumbled, because regardless whether anyone ever proves that anything they did that night was illegal, anybody with a brain and two eyes knows that the situation could have been handled better. I want you to be able to dance instead of stumble, as I have learned to do, and I offer here a couple of case histories to show what kind of results you might expect. Both involve people who have attended my seminars and have used the verbal judo techniques to great avail. While each has many stories of success in everyday dealings and negotiations, both have also soared on paper as little Davids doing written battle, one with a Goliath corporation and the other with a high-powered businessman. Both the corporation and the businessman tried to intimidate my protégés and might have scared off someone who had no ammunition, but you will see that verbal judo made my guys equal to the task in both cases. The Water System from Hell. My client, whom I'll call Rick, and his wife, needed a water softening system and a drinking water purifier. They scheduled a meeting with a sales representative from a supplier, but the man who arrived was not the salesman. Rather, he said he was a sales manager in an executive position who had been forced to handle the house call because the root salesperson had had to cancel at the last minute because of a social engagement. This sales manager acted rushed and perturbed that he had to handle such a lowly task, but assured Rick and his wife that they would be the beneficiaries of the snafu. He had a personal vendetta against the salesman, and would thus sell both the softener and the purifier at cost. That would result in no commission for the salesman, and the sales manager said he would use the sale as a case lesson for his staff. He bragged that this would prove to his staff that he could sell the company's products under any circumstances. He breezed through his presentation, apparently eager to get going, and was unable to produce documentation for his company's claims of research, showing that their system would eliminate the need for hair conditioners and fabric softeners, reduce the need for soap, produce a no-maintenance bathroom, and cut water bills to the bone. He used to carry such documentation, he said, when he handled house calls. Rick and his wife expressed their reluctance at getting into the middle of an office politics situation, but they could not ignore the huge price break. They had no reason to doubt the sales manager's word about the research studies and the water bill savings, so they signed the contract. The sales manager stayed long enough only to gloat again about how he would use the deal to show his people how sales could be done, even in difficult circumstances. When the system was installed, it seemed to run for several hours, water gushing down the drains. Rick called to see if this was normal and was told a serviceman would come that night. No one came. Reddish beads turned up in tap water, toilets, sinks, and tubs. The next day, Rick turned on the shower, only to be blasted with the little beads he eventually learned were from the resin system designed to infiltrate the system. When a serviceman finally came to check, Rick learned that the system had indeed malfunctioned and had dumped its entire tank of resin beads into the water supply. As Rick had ingested some of these in his shower, he was naturally concerned with his health. But that was not all. Clearly, the installer had been inexperienced. He left a mess, including a gaping hole in the drywall. He left greasy tools on a piece of Rick's luggage. The washing machine had become so clogged with resin that the pump had to be replaced. The water heater had heavy residue from the beads. Meanwhile, the system continued to malfunction. It would come on in the middle of the morning and shake the whole house, and the family noticed no savings in soap or conditioners. Their water bill increased sixfold. When it became clear to Rick that the entire system was a disaster, he contacted the company, only to discover that the sales manager had misrepresented himself and had since been reassigned. Rick believed he was getting satisfaction when the company agreed to replace the system. Promised to send documentation that his health would not be threatened by his resin shower, and urged him to try out the system, which would be fully explained at a later date, before paying anything. Part of the original sales plan had included regular deliveries of salt. None came. The documentation regarding health-related issues and the chemistry of the resin was never sent. Rick did not receive any printed material or explanation of the system that would have told him what was normal and what was not, how the system best functioned, and what to expect. What he and his wife did receive next was their bill, which had been turned over to a collection agency and was soon to be litigated. I don't know about you, but I would have been ready to go to war. Phrases like, "How dare you?" and "Who do you think you're dealing with?" would have come to my mind. To Rick's credit, while he was forthright and unequivocal in his letter, he did much more than simply recount the history of the case, which is always a good idea. He could have ranted and raved and made all manners of threats and accusations. Rather, he clearly stated his personal offense at having been contacted by a collection agency and having been threatened with legal action when it was clear to him that it was he who had the case against the supplier. Instead of leveling a written version of "See you in court," he outlined how he thought he had been shortchanged, asked for restitution, and insisted on the company calling off the collection agency, using variations of the following language. "I await your earliest response, in view of our desire to avoid a court case, a feeling I assume would be shared by you and your company. I would ask that," later he added, "I trust we can work things out smoothly and professionally." In subsequent correspondence, when this approach seemed to be working, Rick looked for other areas of agreement. He wrote such things as, "I feel you have taken some good initial steps in helping to alleviate the serious problems I outlined in my letter. My meeting with Blank was cordial, and he proved to be a fine tribute to your office." While Rick continued to fear for his health, he even allowed, "I am neither a chemist nor a doctor, and do not want to suggest that the pains are linked to my ingestion of the resin beads. However, I would like to close the door to that possibility, and I will be able to do that by receiving the above-mentioned data from you." He continued, "With that in mind, I would ask that you take additional action and waive all charges on this transaction. I challenge every dollar of this account." And then Rick concluded with what I often encourage as a solid verbal judo technique. He painted a word picture that allowed his target audience to envision exactly what was going on. "I feel not unlike a gentleman farmer who buys what he thinks is a prize cow, but is shipped a raging bull. After the buyer has been gored, some immediate concessions are made by the seller. The shirt with its gaping hole will be replaced, and all cosmetic repairs will be covered at no cost. Bull food for a year will also be covered. But then the farmer has slipped a bill for the bull itself. Sir, I am grateful for the bull food, but can you do something about the bull? Please take another look at the figures in previous correspondence. I'd be appreciative if we could come to a meeting of the minds by the end of the year." Best of all, once the matter was finally settled to Rick's satisfaction, he followed up with a note of thanks. It would have been easy to shoot a stinger back, gloating about the victory. But the company had eventually done the right thing, and Rick wrote, "Thank you again for your assistance in resolving these matters. We are well aware that in any business, problems occur. What sets companies apart is how such problems are dealt with. Despite advertising claims about service, too often the customer loses. And so we have been encouraged to see our case handled in such a forthright manner. The professionalism displayed by you and your assistant has been refreshing indeed." Mano a mano. The other success story from one of my satisfied students, I'll call him Chris, is this. Chris, a businessman, ran into a real buzzsaw in the person of a businessman who apparently used intimidation as a common negotiating tactic. Chris had simply requested business references from him, standard practice when you're about to enter into an agreement with someone. He wrote the man, whom I'll call Frank, "I was able to reach two of the business references your office provided, but they weren't of much help. The first wouldn't take my call or call me back. The second gave me a minute to ask a couple of questions and then offered to negotiate the deal if I needed help. The only help I need is for somebody to stand up and say, 'Frank's a great guy, he cuts a fair deal, and I'd gladly do business with him again. Please let me know if you can provide any references that will assure me. It's a fair thing to ask.'" He then clearly challenged Frank's unfair deal terms, stating, "These are basic questions that perhaps you'd prefer were left unasked, but not asking them would be an irresponsibility on my part." Chris expressed his willingness to meet face-to-face, but added, "However, perhaps it's fortuitous that we haven't met, in light of your earlier threat. Don't mess with me, I'm Sicilian." Or maybe it wasn't a threat. "I honestly have trouble differentiating between what you say and reality as I know it." "I gotta tell you, if that happened to me, I would have to be reminded to stay in my verbal judo mode to keep from placing a few calls to my friends and having 50,000 cops land on Frank's doorstep. In this case, the student handled it better than the teacher would have." In the letter, Chris then moved to humor in an attempt to counterbalance Frank's sweeping denigration of a group of people. "Either way, I can assure you that I don't want to wake up with a horse's head in my bed, if that's what you mean." He concluded, "All of this is to say, Frank, I think it would be prudent to start trying to mend fences, and I think your attorney would advise the same if you gave him a copy of this letter. We're all pretty decent people on the other ends of these telephone lines. We also have solid reputations, simple values, a distaste for being messed with, which we apparently share with Sicilians, and when you know it, even a readiness to grab hold of an olive branch, if there's one anywhere in sight." That letter, because of its tone and its expert use of verbal judo techniques, took Chris from an acrimonious situation to harmony overnight. One day he was receiving threats and charges and ultimatums, from Frank's insisting that he would not do business with anyone if Chris was involved, to his telling Chris that Chris's clients would go broke when Frank sued them. The next day after that letter arrived in Frank's mailbox, whether he showed it to his lawyer, Chris isn't sure, he called Chris with a laugh in his voice. The tension was gone. He even offered Chris a writing job, telling him he had no idea Chris could put words together on paper like that. They got together for lunch, continued negotiating, and eventually inked a lucrative deal for all parties. From all walks of life. My memory is full of testimonials from seminar attendees who have borne witness to the benefits of verbal judo. I hear from them all the time. There's the woman from Southern California who was sent to the seminar by her employer and who saw a huge decrease in complaints about her department. But even more important, she believes verbal judo saved her marriage. She began talking to her husband the way she wanted to be spoken to by him. He was surprised, bemused, and suspicious at first, but as she stuck with it, he grew to like it. Her ego was in the background. She was practicing the golden rule. Eventually, he felt conspicuous being the bad guy in a marriage with such a wonderful, loving wife, and his behavior began to change. She says she has taught him to be a verbal judo expert without his even being aware of it. I've heard from cops who have been estranged from their kids, either because of divorce or separation, or just because of the demands of the job. With verbal judo techniques, they were able to say things they had never been able to say before, and they've seen friendships formed and relationships healed. They think it's magic, and that I'm some sort of family healing guru. But verbal judo is just common sense. I admit I have the right background for this type of a thing. I needed verbal judo myself, being a difficult person. I became a student of rhetoric and literature. I overcame a speech handicap. I worked in the trenches, where you have to be able to communicate to stay alive. And I perfected physical martial arts skills, which I found transferred beautifully to this program. Yet I maintain there is no magic to it, no deep secrets. Learn the principles so that even when the myriad techniques don't come immediately to mind, you'll know the general objective. Make verbal judo a way of life, and watch yours change for the better. Chapter 27. Verbal Judo as an Automatic Response. My goal in this chapter is to present you 26 of the most compelling ideas I have gleaned from the streets. As I have emphasized, just about anything that works in the crucible of the street can be adapted and transferred to everyday life. I have a list of maxims and credos I call secret power samurai. If you take the time to think these through and memorize them, they will spring to mind when you're in a crisis. Consider this a refresher course on much of what has gone before. Reminders of the phrases that will allow you, under pressure, to marshal your communication strength in ways that might surprise you. Some of these may seem clear and obvious, while others may amaze you, but each can markedly contribute to your ability to become a fine verbal communicator. These principles will help you affirm the truth of the famous Sun Tzu, who once said, "To win 100 victories in 100 battles is not the highest skill. To subdue the enemy without fighting, that is the highest skill." A more modern martial arts figure, the late Bruce Lee, said it this way, "You and your opponent are one." In other words, you coexist and you become his complement, absorbing his attack and using his force to overcome him. If you have gained nothing else from this book, remember that the principle of verbal judo is the same as that of physical judo. Instead of pushing back and confronting, you want to redirect, using the energy of the other. According to Sun Tzu and Li, two famous fighters, 2,000 years of encounters have taught us that the most powerful warriors are people who do not engage in physical conflict. Power is knowledge in action. If you put to work the knowledge contained in this book, you will develop the power to stay calm and to achieve self-esteem when others expect you to stumble. That is, the subtle power to get what you want without being obvious about it. If your technique is too obvious, people sense you are trying to manipulate them, and you'll fail for sure. The man who has mastered an art reveals it in his every action. I've lived verbal judo now for nearly 2 decades. I learned it slowly, made a lot of mistakes, and have the physical and emotional scars to prove it. That's why I want you to take these maxims seriously, so that every time you interact with people, you can put them into effect. Your goal should be to make verbal judo a natural response, something in your character that reveals itself to your children, to the plumber who tries to hand you a bill you think is too high, to the contractor who is taking longer than you think he ought, or to the supervisor you think is unfair. Use the skills represented by these maxims to redirect behavior rather than getting into an ugly confrontation. If the thought of memorizing all of them overwhelms you, select 5 favorites and try to put them into action tomorrow. Use them with your family, your peers, your colleagues, your public. The Principles of Impartiality. The twins of great communication are the same great twins of police work. 1. Always maintain your professional face. Never strive to save your personal face. Your personal face is ego on your sleeve, your expression of irritation, anger, and bias. I would have paid somebody to teach me that principle when I was 21. 2. Always treat the other person as you would want to be treated under identical circumstances. This is really the golden rule, isn't it? It's in the Bible, and we've heard it all our lives, but how many of us live it out? The next time your children misbehave, treat them as you wish you had been treated when you were that age. Too often people grow up and become just like the parents they resented. That's why child abuse is perpetuated through the generations. These twin principles of communication are easy to recite, but hard to implement. Most of the mistakes I've made can be traced directly to my failure to follow them. I've either allowed my personal face to come through, or I have failed to even think of the golden rule. More on my list. 11. Avoid the depersonalization of abstraction. Keep your language specific. Abstraction has a killing quality. Airlines, for example, too often refer to passengers as fares. The U.S. government managed to depersonalize the Vietnam War for many years by referring to the dead as casualties, VC or GIs. We didn't lose any George Thompsons or John Smiths. We lost a Viet Cong or a government issue, which, like a rifle or a blanket, is inventory. No longer a person. I recommend addressing older people by their last names. "Excuse me, sir, your last name again? Mr. Johnson?" "Mr. Johnson, I have a question." If you're talking to a younger man, I recommend using his first name. "Excuse me, sir, may I call you Jim?" "Jim, I'm curious about..." That specificity suggests that you care. Abstract depersonalization is destroying our society. Don't let your children label a person racially instead of as an individual, or they will never be able to skillfully or successfully interact with those different from themselves. Teach them the power and dignity of specificity and personalization. 12. Use positive feedback when you least feel like it. It's easy to be positive with someone you feel good about. There's real skill in being positive when what you feel is negative. One busy Saturday night, I responded to a call about an underage kid in a bar. He gave me a lot of trouble, and it took me 10 minutes to talk him out of there. It was a dangerous place, so I played it smart, not getting rough and causing a disturbance. When he finally walked out the front door, he said sarcastically, "All right, officer, I'm out of the bar now." It was all I could do not to say what I felt. I wanted to threaten him and throw him in the squad car, but I was testing this very principle. I forced myself to realize that I had gained some voluntary compliance, sarcastic as he was. Did he come out? Yes. Was his attitude bad? Yes. Is that unusual? No. I decided to emphasize the positive and see what happened. I said, "Let me tell you something," and I could see him getting ready for some negative feedback. But I said instead, "I really appreciate your coming out. It's a busy Saturday night, and I've got better things to do than get into a tussle with you." "And you must have something better to do than get into a tussle with the police and go to jail. Look, we're talking about a minor report. What do you say we skate on over to that patrol car a half a block away, get this juvenile summons done, and you're on your way? No big deal. What do you say?" You should have seen the look on that guy's face. He said okay, and I was gone in 5 minutes. Paperwork done, back to serve the public. If I had emphasized the negative and gone with my instincts, it could have resulted in chaos, a fight, backups called, lots of paperwork, and time out of service. As it was, I got maximum effectiveness with minimum effort. Try that with the people in your orbit. Do the unexpected. If they expect you to be negative, be positive. 13. Use self-talk to maintain control when under assault. Remember your acronyms. PAVPO, Perspective, Audience, Voice, Purpose, Organization. The overview of rhetorical perspective. PACE, Problem, Audience, Constraints, Ethical Presence. The way to read a scene. LEAPS, Listen, Empathize, Ask, Paraphrase, Summarize. The five great tools of communication. 14. Never violate the equity principle. Treat people equally, regardless of their age, race, appearance, or apparent value to you. 15. Cultivate your constituency. Don't try to run people's lives. If a customer or an employee is difficult, for example, try going the extra mile for him. He's not expecting that, and he will never forget it. Every time you touch somebody with words, you have an opportunity to make him feel better about his relationship with you. That gives you ultimate power. For the toughest cases. Many of the rest of these principles are from the ancient samurai, some from my street experience, and all have been tested in the verbal judo laboratory of real life. They relate more to situations that have escalated to an emotional pitch and have the potential to turn ugly. 16. It's not enough to be good. You've got to look good and sound good, or it's no good. To make that easier to remember, you might cast it in shorthand the way the ancient samurai may have said it. Not enough to be good. Got to look good or no good. In today's society, it's no longer enough to simply do the right thing. There are too many video cameras, too many tape recorders, and too many people who will sue you or make your life miserable if you're wrong in one point of procedure. Right or wrong, you can still be in trouble if you don't carry yourself and represent yourself or your employer in the right way. 17. Say what you want as long as you do what I say. Needless to say, this is a major street principle for the police. I teach that they should allow a citizen to say what he wants as long as he cooperates. Who cares what he says? He's usually just trying to save face. Remember this when dealing with your children. Unless they're so disrespectful that that in itself is cause for discipline, let them grumble about what you've told them, as long as they comply. Being able to gripe a little gives them the feeling that they still have some say about what happens in their life, even though in reality you are holding the reins. The only time this is not advisable is when your target audience is on the verge of being out of control, and his own words can trigger an adrenaline rush in him or in bystanders that will prove dangerous. The same is true at home. Let your children say what they want as long as they aren't getting a sibling or your spouse agitated at the same time. When that happens, you need to address not just their actions, but also their words. Draw a very clean line and move to discipline. In other words, before things get out of hand, you might have to say, "You, be quiet. You go to your room now, and I'll be in to see you in a minute. You put that down and wait here for me." 18. "You can have the last word, because I have the last act," is a principle associated with the previous one. Obviously, it is a police principle, and does not apply when you're simply trying to negotiate with a service person or an equal. But if you're a parent or a boss, it applies. You don't want to flaunt it or say it, but knowing it will give you great confidence. Your employee can cuss you out and flip over your desk, and if it fits your purpose, you can sit there smiling benignly. He knows as well as you do that the final verdict, likely his dismissal, lies with you. 19. Never use those words that rise most readily to your lips. For the moment you do, you will give the greatest speech you'll ever live to regret. This is the one I've personally proven more times than I care to remember. I'm an expert at verbal karate, lashing out at people, angering them, burning bridges. Never once has it resulted in anything positive. I say my piece and feel great temporarily, see number 21, and then I spend months or years dealing with the fallout of a broken relationship. The words that rise most readily to your lips are always reactive rather than responsive. You must choose your words with an eye on the goal. What is the one thing I want to accomplish? 20. If it doesn't work with Mama, don't use it on the street. This is merely a simple way to remember that you have to treat everyone as you treat your family. If it doesn't work to tell your spouse or your kids calm down, then don't try it with the public. 21. If it makes you feel good, no good. If you say the thing that makes you feel the best, 9 times out of 10 you're making a mistake. Sadly, it makes you feel good to stroke your own ego, to put somebody down, or to tear into someone. The only exceptions to this principle are when what makes you feel good is something you know will also make the other person feel good, or when you're using strip phrases as deflectors. Appreciate that. Understand that. Oh, yes. 22. Never step on someone's personal face. Allow most everyone to save face. Remember, you have the last act, so there's no need to put people down. I wish somebody had told me that when I was a teenager, because for many years I made a habit out of doing just that, and it resulted in nothing but broken relationships. You can get into a person's space, but never in his face. If as a police officer I told somebody, "Hey you, come here," he'd immediately back up. To a person in trouble, "Come here" means go away. What I had to do was to go to him in a non-threatening manner. When I got in close proximity, I'd say, "Excuse me, sir, may I chat with you?" By then I might have been only about 1.5 feet from him, but because I was non-threatening, I was not in his face. 23. The less ego you show, the more power you have over others. It takes a healthy ego to be a leader, a mover, and a shaker. I admit I have a good deal of confidence in myself and my ability to communicate, speak, and teach. But if I got up in front of an audience and bragged about that, I would lose them. Put your ego into your job, into the people you supervise, into your goals. But don't show your ego by revealing your personal face in verbal encounters. The most common complaint about supervisors is that they have their heads in the air, their noses turned up. They think they're better than us. That's exactly how not to create a cohesive team. Great teams are built by leaders who channel their egos into their people. The best supervisor will come to work every day to make his people better than he ever was. That was a goal of the ancient masters, to see their students go beyond them. Success comes from others. Put your power into others, let them carry the day, and you will be seen as a successful leader. 24. Men are like steel. When they lose their temper, they are useless. Fine-tempered steel has strength. Steel that lacks temper breaks under stress. This is another principle that goes back to the samurai. 25. When your mouth opens, your ears slam shut. Too many people think leadership has to do with talking, but great leadership has more to do with listening. When you're talking, you cannot listen. Listening is a highly active, artificial skill. 26. Common sense is most uncommon under pressure. Everybody from customers